Hello and welcome back to Food Toxicology. I'm Greg Muller, the instructor for the course. The question I pose to you here today is how many of you have opened the refrigerator and looked at that bowl of leftovers from a few days ago and had to make a little bit of a risk assessment because there was a little bit of mold on there and could I just scoop it off and perhaps eat that tasty meal? We've all experienced, in terms of our own food system, the appearance of mold, whether it's there as a byproduct in terms of shelf stability or as a part of the food that we eat, for example, the mold that is in many cheeses. The title of today's lecture is Toxic Mold and Mycotoxins, and what we hope to do is to give you a little bit of a background in this other category of food toxins. Today's learning objectives, what we're going to try to do is understand the relationship between mold growth and their potential mycotoxins and mycotoxicosis, or mycotoxin-induced disease. We're going to try to explore some of the environmental conditions for mold growth, how it occurs in nature, understand the major species of toxic molds. There's a little bit of a differentiation there. This is not a mycology course, but we're going to try to give you some idea of these major toxic molds of concern and their disease endpoints. We'll try to review the route of exposure to mycotoxins and some of the general pharmacologic effects and the clinical disease presentations associated with mold and mycotoxin. And we'll try to finish off with the discussion of a recent mycotoxin outbreak in Kenya. Well, fungi and mycotoxins, there's about 100,000 species or greater of fungi. It's a very diverse kingdom. Mycotoxins are defined as substances that are produced by these fungi that are harmful to animals or humans. We've had about 300 or more mycotoxins isolated in terms of our research analysis of this particular form of toxin. About 30 of these are well characterized in terms of not only their presentation, but their mode of action, their metabolism, and their toxic endpoints. These are typically ones that are associated with the presentation of human disease and also create a food safety risk. I have a picture down at the bottom of an enlarged corn kernel with a mold infestation on that corn kernel, and we'll talk about some of the molds that grow on corn. Now, mold growth can lead to mycotoxin production. This has a lot to do with the plants, the specific plants involved, the substrate for the mold, environmental factors in terms of field factors and storage factors that include temperature, humidity, moisture, and oxygen availability. Crop damage will increase the potential for mycotoxin production. Crop damage might result from parasites, drought, or pesticides. Now, in terms of the observations, the general observations we have about mycotoxins is not all moldy feeds or foods contain mycotoxins. So the risk assessment that you do has to bear this in mind in terms of your own refrigerator. Not all feeds or foods that do contain mycotoxins are toxic, and this has a lot to do with the dose and the relative toxicity of the particular chemical compound at hand. The food or the feed does not have to look moldy to be contaminated. So for example, in corn meal, rarely are you going to be able to actually see the fungal spores or the fungus. For contaminated peanuts or peanut butter, you won't be able to necessarily see the mold associated with the intoxication risk of contaminated foods. And the other problem associated with mycotoxin observations is that because it is a mold growth, it may grow in one area of a, for instance, a corn silo, but it might not be growing in another part of the silo. And so the analysis, the follow-up investigations, the clinical investigations from mycotoxicoses sometimes are frustrated by finding the source because again, how do you sample something that may be a large sample where the mold is not uniformly distributed? In terms of toxic mold disease endpoints, we have four major categories: allergy, mycosis, irritation, and mycotoxicosis. Allergy is a sensitization to the mold or mold products, whereas mycosis is actual infection by the fungus organism itself. We can have an irritation associated with the mechanical effects of spores that have been inhaled, the mycelial debris, or the volatile organics that are produced by some types of mold and fungus. Historically, you will recall our comments in here that there were some forms of mold impacting medieval and later wallpapers in Europe that contained heavy metals such as arsenic for pigments that volatilized some of the arsenic and led to arsenicosis in inhabitants in these rooms. Mycotoxicosis is the final category, and this is where we actually have a mycotoxin and a clinical disease manifestation. In terms of looking at a matrix of the major categories of toxic molds and the disease outcome, the fungus categories, Stachybotrys, Coccidioides, Claviceps, Fusarium, Aspergillus are the major categories. You can see by the presentation on this matrix of a plus symbol, a plus minus symbol, or a minus symbol for not reported suggests that the toxic molds have a significant endpoint in allergy, mycosis, irritation, and all except for Coccidioides, mycotoxicosis. So we don't have mycotoxins necessarily being produced by that particular species. Now, mycotoxins, why do these toxins appear in molds? They're considered to be the resting stage secondary metabolites. These compounds are typically low molecular weight. Like many secondary compounds, they're not required for growth. You have to ask the question, why do they appear? And we could probably answer that in terms of ecological biochemistry. It probably is an energy storage product or competitive advantage in terms of enhancing or decreasing the possibilities of predation. There are beneficial uses of mycotoxins. We're all aware of the use of penicillin from Penicillium mold, and there are other drugs that are extracted from various types of fungi. The adverse effects of some mycotoxins include just generalized toxicities that we'll talk about, as well as the potential for carcinogenesis. Stachybotrys is a common fungus associated with hay and cellulose products. You'll find this in water-damaged buildings. It sometimes is referred to as toxic house mold. If you're from the Midwest or the southeastern part of the United States, where the conditions for this mold growth are ripe, so to speak, you probably have read in the local newspapers about toxic house mold and the management of potential, minimizing the potential for toxic house mold. There are some issues associated with the relative risks of these molds. Are they indeed as toxic as the media would have you believe? In terms of Stachybotrys, this is a picture of Stachybotrys contaminated straw on the top. You see the dark fungal deposition on this. Persons handling this kind of straw obviously can be exposed to this particular fungus and its toxins. This is an image of a water-damaged wall in a house and fungal deposition, fungal growth, mold growth on this from Stachybotrys. This typically is an indicator of some potential for sensitization, be it allergy sensitization or intoxication through this mold. It's not a good thing to have around a house and typically is going to encourage the homeowners to do quite a bit of renovation. Stachybotrya toxicosis in animals, the clinical progression, there's an irritation of the mouth, throat, and nose, shock, dermal necrosis, leukopenia. There can be pulmonary effects in terms of inflammation and hemorrhage, and then following nervous disorder and death. There were several historical observations of toxicity from Stachybotrys. In 19th century Russia, there was numerous veterinary and human epidemics. Clinical condition we'll describe in more detail later, ATA or alimentary toxic aleukemia. In 1931, a large incidence in Ukraine from inhalation of mold from hay and contaminated bedding. In terms of occupational exposure, we occasionally hear it about it in cottonseed oil plants, grain elevators, malting plants, and as various textile mills that use organic materials. In 1996, employees at a German horticultural facility actually experienced dermal irritation working with disposable paper plant containers that had had a significant amount of Stachybotrys mold growth on them. The toxins associated with this type of mold are given here on this slide just to illustrate. These are quite often cyclic compounds of various sizes and dimensions. The variability of these is difficult in terms of tracking specific metabolic pathways and impacts in terms of the progression of clinical disease. Stachybotrya toxicosis in humans, if we have inhalation or dermal exposure, the clinical progression starts with a dermatitis. This is what was experienced by the workers in the German horticultural facility. They had an irritation followed by a sloughing of the skin on their fingertips. Upper respiratory symptoms, fever, leukopenia, headache, fatigue, and then typical recovery following removal of the source. The linkage between Stachybotrya toxicosis and human disease has been explored in epidemiological study by the CDC. They have not found a linkage between infantile pulmonary hemorrhage, which is typically the cause of death in individuals where there is a potential for etiologic linkage between toxic mold and human health. But they found that the data was insufficient to make that linkage. Next group of toxic mold is coccidioides. This gives you a micrograph of this slide and the spores that you can kind of see within each of the components. It was first described in 1894 in California, referred to as valley fever. It comes from the inhalation of the fungal hyphae. Most cases are asymptomatic or self-revolving. The x-ray here, the chest x-ray, shows some nodular infiltrates characteristic of some of the inflammation associated with coccidiomycosis. Coccidiomycosis is actually a disease of the Americas, referred to again as valley fever from its first presentation in the San Joaquin Valley. You can see in terms of the yellow colors here how it comes up to the southeastern part of the United States and into the Central Valley of California, but does actually, it is endemic in certain parts of the central part of South America. CDC refers to it as an emerging disease. There were significant blips in terms of epidemiological monitoring of this disease in Southern California in the early 1990s. It caused a significant amount of concern. People that are immune compromised are at risk in terms of battling this particular fungal infection. The symptoms of coccidiomycosis include acute bronchitis, chills, sore throat, pneumonia, and leukocytosis. The progression of the disease starts with a fever and then anorexia and late weight loss, some skin ulcerations and abscesses. You can see this on this image here on this particular slide. progressive cyanosis, potentially renal and hepatic involvement in the full progression of this particular disease without clinical therapeutic treatment. Our next category of toxic mold is claviceps, such as Claviceps purpurea, Claviceps paspalli. It grows in wet and overwintered grains, particularly rye, barley, and wheat. It's characterized by the developments of sclerotia or ergots, and so you'll hear this referred to as ergots. These ergots are hard-packed fungal tissue or mycelium. You can see it in this particular grain image, these dark ergots that appear. These are hard-packed accumulations of the mold. Ergotism is the clinical syndrome associated with claviceps intoxication. It can lead to gangrene and convulsions and GI impact in livestock, decreased weight gains, milk production, and reproductive efficiencies. In terms of the chemical compounds associated with ergots, ergotamine is the one that is most studied. It's an analog of LSD, and so it's a hallucinogenic. It is a vasoconstrictor. It can lead to gangrene and a condition referred to as St. Anthony's fire. This gives you an idea of what the molecular structure of ergotamine is. Historically, the presentation of ergot toxicity in humans, because of its hallucinations, because of the general psychoactive aspects of this particular intoxications, these individuals were sometimes regarded as possessed, especially by church officials, because of their clinical manifestations. In fact, in this next article, which I'll leave you to read, it talks about that perhaps the Salem witch trials were not much more than the diagnostic misinterpretation, perhaps, of ergotism from the crop storage associated with early Massachusetts and ergotism presentation in some individuals, and that toxic impact, neurotoxic impact in terms of their behaviors. How does ergot exposure occur? The particular fungus grows in soil, and the spores can be released when grain flowers. It lands on the stigma, it germinates, and the hyphae extend into the ovary, where it actually replaces the ovary or the part of the seed. The hardened ergot body or sclerotium actually becomes a part of the grain recycle as it drops back to the soil, infects the soil, and then recycles in the next generation of grain grown on the land. Now, how this happens in terms of human exposure, the seeds and the ergots, these dark granules contaminating the seed head, are harvested together. In typical processing for crops that have potential for ergot exposure, there can be screening techniques to actually separate the ergots based on size and weight. Human exposure occurs by ingesting grain or food impacted from ergots. Now, the ergot toxins are actually very bioactive chemical compounds. They include ergonovine, ergovaline, ergosine, ergocrystine, and primarily ergotamine. Ergotamine is actually produced medicinally for vascular problems, for migraine headaches, and for postpartum uterine hemorrhage in childbirth or in abortions. The types and concentrations of alkaloids vary on a case-by-case basis in terms of its presentation in ergots. The pharmacological effects of ergots include vasoconstriction. This vasoconstriction does lead to gangrene. It's a serotonin agonist, so there are the potential for neurological effects. There are dopamine effects as well. It's an agonist. agalactia, which is the lack of flow of milk following childbirth, is one of the pharmacological effects of ergot. In terms of the vasoconstriction leading to gangrene, this is has the appearance of advanced frostbite. Historically, there have been many human toxicoses associated with ergot clinical disease. In France in 944 AD, there's documentation of about 40,000 people dying from gangrenous limbs. Its presentation starts with pain and swelling and numbness, following by a necrotizing of the tissue, and then death, or in the cases of pregnant individuals, pregnant women, abortion of the fetus. The clinical disease, from a neurological point of view, the individual presents with tremors and convulsions, tingling, feeling like ants crawling under the skin, St. Elmo's fire. There's itching, numbness, twitching, spasms, and seizures. This all has it changes in individual's behavior, and you can look back in terms of historical presentation, especially in medieval times, of ergotism in terms of a mental presentation and perhaps a misinterpretation of a disease being a possession by evil spirits. In terms of USDA and FDA, there are action levels set for ergots in grains. Our next category of toxic molds is one that is of great concern, especially in developing countries, fusarium. It affects corn, wheat, and barley. There are veterinary and public health concerns. The major toxins associated with fusarium molds are trichothecines, zearalenone, and fumonisin. The trichothecines, zearalenone, and fumonisin occur simultaneously in various types of species of fusarium, and they have different potential clinical presentations. The trichothecines are sesquiterpenoid tetracyclic compounds. This particular type of compound, because of its toxicity and the acute nature of its toxicity, has seen some use in biological warfare. There's a record of its potential use in Laos and Cambodia during and after the Vietnam War. There was a potential for it having been used as well in Iraq during the Saddam Hussein regime in terms of his war against the Kurds. The trichothecines or T2 toxins include T2 toxins, nivalenol and DON or deoxynivalenol, which we've talked about in terms of biotransformation. These contain epoxide rings, and there is a potential for reactivity with those epoxides in biotransformation and metabolism. The metabolism of T2 toxin in terms of hepatic microsomes, you see a phase one metabolism increasing the number of hydroxyl groups on it. In terms of intestinal microflora biotransformation, the epoxide is broken down. The metabolites of T2 are less toxic than the T2 parent compound. In terms of animal toxicity associated with T2, digestive disorders, feed refusal, bloody diarrhea, intestinal problems, hemorrhage associated with the stomach, heart intestines, edema or swelling, oral lesions, blood disorders. It's immunotoxic. We find that the LD50 of T2 toxin is about 3 to 5 milligrams per kilogram. And the dose response curve, if you look at the shape of the dose response curve, it's very steep, and that's an indication of rapid transition from no or low effects to very high effects in terms of percent of lethalities. T2 is a dermal toxin. This image is a skin lesion from a hairless guinea pig. at one day after the application of 2550, 100 and 200 nanograms of T2 and 2 microliters of methanol, you can see that even after one day, this can be regarded as being a blistering agent. Blistering agents are actually a category of chemical warfare agents. When human skin is exposed in vivo, and this has happened through laboratory accidents in terms of individuals working with this particular toxin, very small amounts, amounts that can go through a hole in a glove, can have a response of severe cutaneous irritations that can last a week or two after the exposure. In terms of human toxicity from T2, the dermal exposure will yield the cutaneous necrosis and inflammation. Oral exposure, excuse me, will lead to lesions in the upper GI and potentially to ATA. Because of the lipophilic nature of trichothecenes, they are rapidly and completely absorbed in the gastrointestinal tract and therefore have the ability to impact all of your major organs. It causes cell death by ribosomal binding, and this leads to an inhibition of protein synthesis. There is a potential as well for ocular exposure and corneal injury. This is more of a chemical warfare type or biochemical warfare type injury. ATA is alimentary toxic Aleukia toxicosis. It goes through four stages. The first stage is immediately after the consumption of grain products. There's an inflammation of the GI and intestinal mucosa, followed by some dizziness, tachycardia, and fatigue. The second stage is characterized by leukopenia, and there is a presentation of a progressive lymphocytosis. The third stage is characterized by the appearance of bright red rashes across the chest and other areas of the body. The fourth stage, these necrotic lesions can heal up and the body temperature can fall, followed by a recovery in many cases. This has to do with a low-dose chronic or acute exposure. The other mycotoxin formed by fusarium is zearalenone, or ZEN. It's found in corn, wheat, barley, oats, sorghum, and hay. Its characteristic environment is one of high humidity and low temperature, kind of like the autumn harvest in the upper Midwest of the United States. It's often coincident with T2, although it does have a different disease presentation. In terms of animal toxicity, we find the dose of greater than a tenth of a part per million in swine will yield estrogenic effects. In larger dose in swine, you'll have a decreased reproduction effect. Cycling, conception, ovulation, all will be impaired. In boars, greater than a tenth of a part per million, zearalenone will yield feminization, testicular atrophy, and enlarged nipples. In cows, we observe decreased conception rates. The mechanism of action of zearalenone is it is an estrogenic disruptor, so it binds to the estrogen receptor. Its binding ability is greater than 17 beta equivalent to 17 beta estradiol, but less than estradiol. The receptor affinity across species is greatest for swine, then rat, then chicken in terms of its comparative toxicity. Fumonisin is another category of mycotoxin. It's universal in corn. It's also found in wheat, barley, oats, sorghum, and hay. It's associated with high humidity and low temperature as well. It's also found coincident with T2. Horses and pigs are considered to be most susceptible to fumonisin toxicity. The particular mycotoxin FB1 is also considered to be the most toxic, and I've given the structure formula on this particular slide. In terms of animal toxicity, fumonisin B1 is neurotoxic. In horses, it causes leukoencephalomalacia, moldy corn toxicosis. There's a rapid onset of this particular disease. There is feed and water refusal, some lameness. There is cerebral edema and liquefaction of some of the parts of the brain. In pigs, you find a disease syndrome called pulmonary edema or porcine pulmonary edema syndrome. It is an edema of the hydrothorax in the lung. It is usually fatal in this species. We find that fumonisin is also a liver carcinogen and a hepatotoxin. In terms of its presentation or its dose to horses, at 1 to 126 parts per million, it can be fatal to horses. It can be a liver toxin at higher doses. In terms of swine exposure, at less than 1 to 5 parts per million, we see hepatic toxicity, but at larger doses, we see acute pulmonary edema associated with the syndrome. In sheep, we've observed nephritis. The FDA Center for Veterinary Medicine has established action levels for fumonisin B1 in animal feeds. Now, there is a concern about fumonisin in the human food chain in terms of its potential as a toxin and a carcinogen. There's questions about its appearance as potential appearance in milk residues and meat residues. In a survey in 1996 in three areas of Costa Rica, 89% of the corn grown in those areas was contaminated with fumonisin from fusarium molds. Fumonisin carcinogenic potential arises because it is a secondary carcinogen. It's a promoter. It's been linked epidemiologically with esophageal cancer in South Africa, Italy, China, and South Carolina. It comes from areas where corn is a staple. It perhaps presents in home-brewed beer that uses corn products, moonshine, and polenta. The final category of toxic molds is Aspergillus. It concerns us because it is a dietary carcinogen, or one of its mycotoxins are dietary carcinogens. The mycotoxin of greatest concern and the one perhaps most studied is aflatoxin B1. The afla and aflatoxin comes from the name of Aspergillus flavus, afla. It's a universal mold food contaminant. It is monitored heavily in the human food system in corn, peanuts, wheat, and rice. It's an animal carcinogen at 5 parts per billion. It's a nice molecule because it is fluorescent, and so contaminated, mold-contaminated materials will give ultraviolet fluorescence. The FDA action level is 20 parts per billion in food. It's a known human liver carcinogen. It binds to the N7 guanine to form a DNA adduct. It's a lung cancer risk in terms of occupational exposure in to grain dusts greater than 4,000 parts per billion of this particular aflatoxin. It's a problem in the food industry and in grain handling for those involved in harvest, transport, storage, or processing of grain products. Aflatoxin B1 does require bioactivation, so this is a classic example in our toxication in our biotransformation discussions. This happens via cytochrome P450. The reaction sequence is listed on this slide, and here we have the substrate being oxidized by cytochrome P450. This is the biooxidation, the bioactivation that happens to aflatoxin B1. The next slide gives you the complex pathways associated with this enzymology. Here we see the activation of aflatoxin B1 to the epoxide over here, the epoxide very reactive. This is what yields DNA binding and potential for mutations and thus carcinogenicity. A more complex representation of the aflatoxin B1 metabolic pathways is given on this slide. If we start off with the parent compound associated with Aspergillus, you can see that there are multiple pathways that this can take. What we find in terms of its metabolic biotransformation, the one that we just looked at, the development of the epoxide, the binding with DNA in terms of N7 guanine interaction forming an adduct, is the track for carcinogenesis. We find the appearance, for example, of aflatoxins from dairy cows. We find aflatoxin presented in the milk in the form of this compound down here, aflatoxin M1. So this gives you an idea of the diversity of metabolic byproducts of aflatoxin B1 in animals. Now, in terms of aflatoxin in the human food chain, there is an etiological role in disease presentation. These have been linked by follow-up studies in epidemiology. This is a situation where food toxicant predisposes the individual to other challenges, be it nutritional or other sorts of disease manifestations. There has been a linkage to Indian childhood cirrhosis, various forms of hepatotoxicity, immune suppression, kwashiorkor, which is the typical starvation presentation in malnourished children especially, and as well its linkage for carcinogenesis. In recent times, in the 1900s and up through the 2004, we've seen aflatoxin outbreaks in terms of animal disease and in human populations. One of the most recent documented outbreaks was in Kenya in between January and July 2004. The CDC was actually called in a supportive role in this disease investigation. There was an outbreak of jaundice and liver failure. There was a high fatality rate associated with the populations afflicted with this particular syndrome of disease. There were 317 reported cases, and of these, 125 were reportedly died from this particular intoxication. That intoxication resulted from consumption of maize that was visibly discolored or moldy. This had a lot to do with famine and also grain storage in this part of Kenya. The corn that was examined had a range of 20 to 8,000 parts per billion aflatoxin. It was widespread over three major communities in Kenya. The maize this particular year was harvested when wet. There was a food shortage. What this does is it demonstrates the need, especially in developing countries, for education on proper harvesting, drying, and food storage to enhance food safety, minimize the impact of toxic mold. So this gives you another perhaps introductory lecture to another aspect of food toxicology. We'll follow this up next time looking at other aspects in terms of the toxicology of food and most specifically the presentation of toxins through the consumption of seafood and marine animals. Until that time, we'll see you later.